Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of sources, articles, research, and your notes, and extract the most important nuggets of knowledge or insight. Think of it as your shortcut to being truly well-informed. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst. We're here to be your expert guides, helping you understand what's most important in the material you've shared.
Today, we're embarking on a fascinating deep dive into the Washington Post for Sunday, September 7th, 2025. This edition is just packed with stories. We're seeing national politics, global events, economic shifts, some intriguing cultural insights, and deeply personal narratives, too. Our mission today is to thoroughly explore each and every one of these articles, report on their content, and then really dig into their impact and implications, providing you with a comprehensive understanding of the day's news.
Indeed. It's a snapshot of a pretty complex world, isn't it? And we'll try to connect the dots for you, revealing that bigger picture and what these developments truly mean. We'll be looking at everything, really, from high-stakes international diplomacy right down to the personal struggles of individuals and even the ethics of our entertainment choices.
Okay, let's get straight into it. Let's unpack this incredible array of information and see what surprises and insights await us. All right, section one. The shifting sands of national politics and governance. We're kicking things off right here in Washington, D.C. It's about Mayor Muriel Bowser and this ongoing issue of federal overreach.
Mayor Bowser she's facing immense pressure. She's getting criticized by D.C. lawmakers and even a coalition of, I think, 100 local organizations.
Yeah, 100. And the criticism is basically that she's appeasing President Trump. This seems to stem directly from her public comments appreciating federal officers and ordering local police to coordinate with them indefinitely.
And her public response is, quite direct. She's basically saying she doesn't care about personal opinions. Her focus, she says, is on protecting this city, our home rule, and preserving our autonomy at every step.
Which sounds strong, especially after Congress indicated it wouldn't extend Trump's emergency takeover of the D.C. police.
Exactly. But her critics, they're deeply concerned. They worry this collaboration, whatever her intentions, is just eroding the city's, you know, already fragile self-government.
Fragile because Congress ultimately controls D.C.'s budget and laws.
Precisely. That's the unique vulnerability here.
You know, this whole D.C. situation really lays bare how local governance can get tangled up in national power struggles. It's fascinating.
It is. And you see the tension play out. Councilmember Zachary Parker, for instance, he talks about the terror effect on residents. He's worried this federal presence creates a false sense of security, especially if the National Guard sticks around through December.
But then you have the other side. Many business leaders, like Kevin Clinton of the Federal City Council, they actually back Bowser's approach. They seem to think she knows how to handle the White House effectively. A pragmatic view, maybe?
Maybe pragmatic, maybe controversial. It really depends on who you ask. In this scenario, it just raises fundamental questions about federalism, doesn't it? How far can a president go in overriding local governance, especially with law enforcement?
And we even see this tension within the D.C. Democratic Party itself.
Right. Charles Wilson, the party chair, seems to trust Bowser's instincts, despite her, you know, surprising shift in tone.
But then council member Janice Lewis-George. She's calling for outright denunciation of the federal intervention.
And she's pushing hard for D.C. statehood as the only real solution to prevent this kind of overreach.
Meanwhile, President Trump seems to see it as a win.
Mm.
He praised Bowser, called his crackdown a giant victory that never has to end.
Yeah. So for you, the listener, this story really underscores D.C.'s unique constitutional spot. It shows the challenges local leaders face when federal power gets asserted like this. It's about local autonomy, civil liberties, the balance of power, especially in crisis times. And it shows deep divisions, even among political allies, on how to handle it.
Okay, so while D.C. deals with its own political battles, the bigger national picture seems shadowed by, economic worries. There's talk the U.S. economy faces a real risk of recession, maybe even before President Trump's promised golden age arrives.
Yeah, the indicators are concerning. Weak job growth is a big one. Only 22,000 jobs added in August. June was actually negative.
And high inflation isn't going away either.
Right. And economists are increasingly pointing fingers at his, let's say, unorthodox policies on tariffs and immigration as the cause.
It's interesting how directly they're linking specific policies to these outcomes. It really challenges that golden age narrative.
It does. Neil Dutta from Renaissance Macro Research, he puts recession odds at close to 50-50, maybe more. That's pretty stark.
Yeah, and Jason Furman, who advised Obama, notes hiring is the weakest in 60 years relative to the economy's size outside of actual recessions.
Yet the administration is mostly dismissing these fears. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick predicts the economy could dazzle again in 6 months.
And Trump himself expects a brilliant job picture in a year, citing AI investments.
And he's also been quite critical of Fed Chair Jerome Powell, calling him too late for not lowering rates sooner.
It's quite a disconnect, isn't it, between the experts and the administration's messaging?
Definitely. Economists are tracing this slowdown back to Trump's Liberation Day tariff offensive in April.
Those tariffs are the highest since the 1930s, apparently.
Which makes things tough for businesses. It likely contributed to the Fed pausing rate cuts.
And then there's immigration policy, the focus on deportations, border closings.
Economists say that's choking off the supply of low-wage workers. You see it in the numbers. Factory employment dropped by 41,000 since February.
It's a contrast to the Biden administration, where immigration was seen as fueling the rebound, boosting labor.
Though one economist quoted here argues that surge in immigration cost them the election. A provocative point.
So for you, this economic debate isn't abstract. It hits job security, cost of living, investments.
Absolutely. It highlights this ongoing tension, protectionism versus free markets, and the real role of immigration in growth. It shows how quickly unconventional policies can, well, reshape your financial landscape.
And adding another layer to this economic discussion, we have a prominent Republican economist, someone who advised George W. Bush and John McCain, issuing daily critiques of Trump's policies.
Yeah, this is significant because it's not just partisan opposition. It's a critique from within the conservative economic world. He's arguing the private sector is dead in the water and that the tariffs are actually pushing inflation up.
Directly impacting consumers there.
Right. And he doesn't hold back. He called Treasury Secretary Bessent's claim that tariffs would raise money and boost GDP gibberish.
Wow. Strong words.
Very. He sees the job reports as a steady bleed. No one's getting fired, but no one is getting hired.
His recession odds match Detta's. 50-50.
Yes, and he says those odds go up with more aggressive tariffs.
But he's not a never-Trumper.
No, the article makes that clear. He criticizes liberal economics, too, like Biden's focus on big government. He seems to be trying to analyze policy purely on merit.
So how does he describe Trump's approach?
He struggles, calls it not an ideology, more capricious. He points to the government taking an equity stake in Intel as an example.
Interesting. And he has a mantra about analyzing policy.
Yeah, basically, analyze policy ideas. It doesn't matter who provided them or how. He learned that lesson back in 2001 with Bush and a farm bill.
So for you, the listener, this perspective offers a critical economic lens outside the usual political noise.
Exactly. It urges you to focus on the consequences of policies, not just the rhetoric or who proposed them.
What?
Analyze the effects.
It really underscores the complexity when there's such disagreement, even within the same broad ideology.
It does. Mm. And it raises questions about the long-term impact of prioritizing loyalty or a unique vision over established economic consensus. How does that affect governance and public trust?
Okay, let's shift slightly, but stick with political strategy. The article points out Trump's rise was fueled by conspiracy theories.
Right. And now that creates a challenge because he leads the very power structure his supporters were taught to distrust. It's a paradox.
It's a fascinating look at how a strategy evolves. Remember birtherism.
Oh, yeah. Before he even ran. The article cites polls from 2011 showing 25% of Americans and 45% of Republicans believed it.
And as president, he used government channels to push other theories, like Social Security funds for dead people or the South Africa farmer issue.
Exactly. Political scientist Joseph Ushinsky argues Trump changed the game by appealing to conspiracy-minded folks, people who believe people in power are doing terrible things to us in secret. It built a coalition based on distrust, not just policy.
And now the strategy is to shoot conspiracy theories at every other thing to change the subject.
That's what the article suggests. For you, understanding this dynamic is just crucial for navigating modern politics.
You have to be able to critically evaluate narratives, separate fact from baseless claims.
It really gets to the heart of modern discourse, doesn't it? And the erosion of trust in institutions. You constantly have to question the source.
Now, here's a story that caused quite a stir. West Point canceling an award ceremony for Tom Hanks.
Yeah, that was surprising and deeply concerning to many.
The official reason given by the West Point Association of Graduates was a desire to focus on preparing officers for war after political controversies involving the Trump administration.
It just shows how deep the political divisions run, doesn't it? When someone like Hanks, with his record supporting veterans, gets caught up like this.
He was supposed to get the Sylvanus Thayer Award for duty, honor, country. Previous winners include presidents, diplomats.
His contributions are undeniable. The WWII Memorial, the Eisenhower Memorial, fundraising for the National WWII Museum. His commitment is clear.
But the political context seems key here. He did a fundraiser with Biden in 2020, hosted Biden's inauguration event, narrated a pro-Biden video.
And pokes fun at Trump supporters on SNL.
Right. So this incident really highlights the increasing politicization of institutions, even military academies.
For you, it's a reminder of how public figures are scrutinized for political affiliations. It could potentially chill nonpartisan advocacy, couldn't it?
It really could.
Yeah.
It forces these institutions into tricky positions, trying to appear neutral in a hyperpartisan time.
Exactly. How do you uphold universal values when everything feels political? It's a tough balance.
Okay, shifting to another presidential topic, Joe Biden's presidential library. He's chosen Delaware.
Yes, and appointed a 13-person board to start fundraising, which, as the article notes, is going to be a big ask.
Especially for Democrats right now, apparently struggling financially after 2024 losses.
Right. They're lagging behind Republicans in cash reserves. And these libraries, the costs have just soared. Clinton's was $165 million. Bush's $500 million.
Obama's over $720 million.
Wow. Yeah. Biden choosing Delaware makes sense, though. It's where his career started, where he served 36 years. His papers are already at the University of Delaware.
And the vision for the library sounds ambitious, not just archives.
No, they want it to be a hub for leadership, service, and civic engagement. An immersive museum covering his presidency, COVID, the American Rescue Act, the infrastructure bill, plus educational spaces, idea incubators.
The board looks high profile, too. Blinken, Ricchetti, Marty Walsh, Shalana Young.
It signals the importance of the project. For you, this highlights the tradition of presidential libraries. They're historical records, yes, but also future centers for engagement. It's about legacy building, fundraising, historical preservation, all rolled into one, shaping how a presidency is remembered.
Now, this next story is fascinating. It really shows the intersection of national and local politics and maybe some behind-the-scenes maneuvering.
You're talking about the New York City mayor's race.
Exactly. Apparently, Trump allies are trying to influence the outcome by getting Eric Adams and Curtis Sliwa to drop out.
How? By offering them administration jobs.
That's what the article reports. It's a pretty unusual level of intervention by a sitting president in a local election.
It definitely raises ethical questions, doesn't it? Using federal power that way. Trump's dislike for Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic Socialist candidate, is well known. He's called him a communist.
And he even suggested Andrew Cuomo might have a better chance in a head-to-head against Mamdani.
Right. The tactics reported are quite specific. Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff meeting Adams, dangling an ambassadorship, maybe Saudi Arabia.
And similar talks supposedly happening with Sliwa. Trump denies it publicly, of course.
But Mamdani still has strong poll numbers, 44% to Cuomo's 25%. And he hit his fundraising cap.
Yep. And Adams and Sliwa are refusing to drop out. Adams called Cuomo a snake and a liar. Cuomo's challenging Mamdani to debates. It's getting messy.
So why Trump's intense interest? The article suggests his New York roots, plus using Democratic cities as a foil for his deportation goals.
For you, it's a rare peek behind the political curtain. Shows the lengths the powerful figures might go to get the results they want. Blurs those lines between federal and local influence.
It really does. A very direct attempt to manipulate an electoral outcome.
Okay, now a major shift in immigration policy. The Board of Immigration Appeals ruled undocumented migrants are ineligible for bond hearings.
Yeah, this affirms an ICE order from July. It means mandatory detention for the duration of their removal proceedings.
Which can take months, even years.
Exactly. And this applies broadly to millions who cross the border over past decades.
Historically, they could request bond hearings, right?
Yeah.
Get released while their case proceeds.
Generally, yes. But the Trump administration revisited its legal position to mandate detention. Parole is now a rare exception, decided by an officer, not a judge.
And this ruling came from the specific test case, a Venezuelan man.
Jonathan Javier Yajur Hurtado, yes. Entered in 2022, got temporary status, which expired, then was apprehended. His appeal became the basis for this broader policy.
What's the legal reasoning? Something about the word shall.
Right. A section of immigration law says unauthorized immigrants shall be detained. The board interpreted shall as a mandatory requirement, unlike may.
But that strict interpretation used to apply mainly to recent crossers.
Historically, yes. Now it's being applied much more broadly, even to long-term residents.
The implications seem huge. Prolonged detention for many.
Absolutely. Significant human rights and legal questions arise. For you, it brings up fundamental issues of due process, immigration policy, agency discretion. It shows how interpreting one word shall can drastically impact millions of lives and alter their legal rights.
From legal interpretations to how political narratives spread globally, let's talk about MAGI using England as a cautionary tale.
Yes, this is interesting. Leaders in the MAGI movement are pointing to Britain as a canary in the coal mine for America. They're attributing problems there to mass migration and radical Islam.
It shows how these populist movements connect across borders, doesn't it? Sharing themes and perceived threats.
Definitely. At a recent National Conservatism conference, Stephen Bannon argued, England is heading to a civil war over radical Islam. Others complained Britain's establishment was too tolerant of Muslim immigrants.
The article says they presented a warped picture of Britain.
Seems so. Praising European parties with anti-Islam, anti-immigration platforms, highlighting illegal crossings of the English Channel 29,000 this year.
And using symbols like the St. George's Cross.
To suggest Brits are wrestling their homeland from Muslim societies vulnerable to Islamist capture. Very potent nationalistic imagery.
Someone even brought up Enoch Powell, the controversial British politician.
Nathan Pinkoski did, warning of a civilizational emergency in Europe, echoing Powell's infamous racialist speech from 68, drawing a direct line to that divisive history.
And Nigel Farage fits into this too.
Yes, the leader of Reform UK, positioned as a potential PM with a mass deportation agenda admired by Trump. He even addressed a U.S. House committee recently.
For you, this really reveals the transnational nature of these movements, how narratives of cultural threat are deployed globally.
It gives insight into the ideology underpinning a major political force and its international connections, how domestic issues get framed using foreign examples.
Okay, this discussion about national identity and external threats leads us to a really crucial question about public health policy.
Right, specifically the consequences when science-based policy gets tangled up with political ideology. We're seeing that clearly with vaccine policy now.
And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now in the top U.S. health post, is central to this. He's reportedly upended vaccine policy.
Leading what's described as a multi-pronged attack on the existing vaccine infrastructure, this has major implications.
We're seeing action at the state level too, right? Like in Florida.
Yes. Florida's Surgeon General, Ladapo, plans to end all school vaccine requirements. That definitely emboldens the health freedom movement. Florida's Butler bill to loosen mandates failed last year, but it shows the momentum, especially in red states.
But Trump's stance seems a bit different. He praised some vaccines, Operation Warp Speed.
It's nuanced, maybe even contradictory. Bannon praised Ladapo, but Trump poured cold water on the anti-vaccine push, saying incredible vaccines should be used. He sees Warp Speed as a major achievement.
So what specific federal changes has Kennedy made?
Since taking office, restricted access to COVID vaccines, dismantled and replaced a key panel of vaccine experts, forced out the CDC director who disagreed with him.
And HHS issued a letter about respecting religious and conscience exemptions for the Vaccines for Children program.
Correct. Experts like Wendy Parmet at Northeastern are warning about a vicious cycle of disinformation and policy changes, designed, she says, to make vaccines harder and harder and harder to get, potentially destroying the whole infrastructure.
The public opinion seems supportive of mandates for things like measles and polio.
Yes, the post-KFF poll showed parents widely support those mandates in Florida and nationally, a real disconnect between policy direction and public sentiment.
So for you, this directly impacts public health, especially kids' health. It reshapes trust in science.
It's a critical discussion about vaccine access, the politicization of health, and the roles of federal versus state governments. You have to consider the long-term public health fallout.
All right, let's shift from national issues to global challenges. We start with Ukraine and its highly sought-after drones.
Right, the gold standard drones. Long-range attacks, seaborne, advanced electronic warfare models. They're very good at overcoming countermeasures.
The world wants them, but Ukraine isn't selling yet. Why not?
Well, it's a tough spot for a country at war, isn't it? They need every single piece of equipment for the front lines, so exports are extremely difficult. Lots of bureaucracy, even though they're technically allowed.
But there's a proposed solution. A new law.
Yes, waiting for Zelensky's signature. It would allow drone companies to set up production lines in Ukraine and abroad, offering tax breaks, simpler customs, more security, letting them produce for Ukraine and foreign markets.
What's the economic thinking behind that?
Crucial revenue. Exports could fund expansion of Ukraine's defense industry. Their production capacity is $30 billion, but current annual production is only $10 billion. Western allies face restrictions on financing, and Ukraine's tax revenue is low.
But there's disagreement internally. The defense minister isn't keen on direct exports.
Denis Shmyhal called it impossible to imagine. He prioritizes Ukrainian forces getting 100+% of what they need. He suggested partnership projects, where weapons stay in partner warehouses. That apparently confused some Ukrainian arms manufacturers.
Because the manufacturers need foreign funding and cooperation to scale up, hire, do R&D, repair facilities.
Exactly. And export limits restrict their access to Western tech through joint ventures.
For you, this highlights Ukraine's strategic dilemma. Immediate war needs versus long-term industrial growth.
It shows how wartime innovation creates valuable products, but also the huge geopolitical and economic hurdles in selling them. War reshapes everything.
This idea of balancing immediate needs with long-term strategy fits perfectly with our next topic, Israel and the West Bank.
A critical global flashpoint, absolutely. And it highlights how regional stability depends on many actors now, not just the traditional powers.
So Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is considering annexing much or all of the occupied West Bank, a move seen as violating international law.
It's a high-stakes decision, driven by complex domestic and international pressures. Domestically, annexation would boost him with voters and allies, especially as more Western countries, UK, Canada, France, pledge to recognize a Palestinian state.
But internationally, it would inflame public opinion across the Arab world and threaten Trump's Abraham Accords.
Precisely. And crucially, the UAE, a key Arab partner from the Accords, sent an unusual message. They said annexation would be a red line, threatening regional integration. That warning apparently got the issue pulled from an Israeli meeting agenda.
So the UAE feels the U.S. and Israel are taking their concerns more seriously now.
That's what Emirati officials believe, yes.
Well, what's the U.S. position? That seems a bit nuanced.
It does. Secretary of State Rubio downplayed annexation as not a final thing and blamed London and Paris for provoking Israel. U.S. policy since 93 supports a Palestinian state, but the Trump administration has been more aligned with Israel's position. Ambassador Huckabee said annexation would be their decision, citing security concerns after October 7th.
And think tanks close to the Israeli government are making security arguments, annexing the Jordan Valley as a critical, non-negotiable security need.
Yes, arguing it's needed to prevent a Palestinian Authority from becoming a platform for jihadism.
For you, this details a major geopolitical flashpoint with huge consequences.
It really explains that complex interplay. Domestic politics, international law, security fears, regional diplomacy in the Middle East shows how many actors shape the path forward.
Okay, now a story impacting U.S.-South Korea relations. A large immigration raid at a Hyundai factory in Georgia.
Yes, 475 workers arrested, over 300 of them Korean nationals. This has definitely added heat to the relationship.
And it was the largest worksite enforcement operation so far in Trump's second term.
That's what the article says, underscores its significance. South Korea's reaction was strong. President Lee Jae-myung pledged all-out efforts to protect Korean nationals. The foreign minister expressed deep concern.
And this comes during tricky negotiations over tariffs and investments. South Korea committed $350 billion in U.S. investments.
Right. In exchange for lower U.S. tariffs, major companies like Hyundai and LG are key to those investments, so the timing is sensitive.
What was the status of the arrested workers?
A mix. Some crossed the border illegally, others lacked work permission or overstayed visas. 47 were LG Energy Solution employees, mostly Korean. 250 were from subcontractors.
For you, this shows how domestic immigration enforcement can directly impact international relations, even with key allies.
It illustrates the challenges foreign businesses face in the U.S. under strict policies, potentially affecting trade and investment. Domestic choices have global ripples.
Back to the Russia-Ukraine war. The assessment seems pretty bleak now. Trump's peace initiative has all but collapsed,
leaving a bloody war of attrition. That seems to be the consensus view presented here. Hopes for a quick diplomatic fix have faded.
But Ukraine has adopted a new strategy, strategic neutralization.
Yes, described by former Defense Minister Zagorodnyuk. It's about acknowledging the grinding reality, not hoping for a quick win. The aim is to paralyze Russia's forces, much like they did in the Black Sea. Systematically obstruct Russian efforts, prevent operational success, even if fighting continues indefinitely.
So it's strategic pessimism. Accepting Trump won't end the war quickly, Europe's guarantees are uncertain.
Exactly. A pragmatic, if sobering, approach based on the current realities.
And the Russian side. General Gerasimov outlined tasks for the future, suggesting more of the same.
The details imply more death and destruction, no decisive breakthrough likely from either side. A prolonged, grinding conflict seems the most probable outcome.
So for you, this offers a strategic overview, focusing on military realities, not political promises.
Right. It highlights innovative strategies like strategic neutralization and gives a starkly realistic assessment of the war's likely path. Urges understanding it as a long-term struggle.
Now, an opinion piece from the Post's View argues Putin ran down Trump's two-week clock, and it's time to rattle Russia.
This piece definitely advocates for a more aggressive stance, a hawkish viewpoint. It notes Trump indicated he understands only real pressure works against Russia, even musing about attacking the invader's country.
He seemed defensive about inaction, pointing to tariffs on India for buying Russian oil, hinting at phase two or three.
Yes, and reportedly browbeat European countries over buying Russian fossil fuels, trying to show he is applying pressure.
The article urges escalation, citing Cold War strategist George Kennan. Russians press until they meet firm resistance.
Right. It points to Putin's blistering strikes on civilians, targeting allies, maybe even daring to target von der Leyen's plane. Arguing this pattern demands a firm response.
For you, this presents a specific perspective on foreign policy, emphasizing pressure, deterrence, historical precedents.
It's a clear call for decisive action, illustrating that ongoing debate about how best to confront aggression and protect interests shows the different strategic philosophies at play.
Okay, let's shift from geopolitics to more personal stories, society, and culture. And we start with an incredible one, musician Mike Fraser's journey with epilepsy.
What a story. It really speaks to resilience and the human spirit. He underwent major brain surgery, removing a piece of his brain about half the size of his fist to combat epilepsy, which affects millions but is often misunderstood.
His symptoms sound harrowing. Excruciating stabbing episodes, paranoia, misdiagnosed initially as panic attacks or digestive issues.
That lack of answers, the pain, led to depression, and crucially for him, it blocked his songwriting, his core identity.
Until Dr. Paul Damian Lyons pinpointed the cause, misfiring nerve cells.
And Fraser chose surgery partly because they weren't sure if the cell cluster was slow-growing cancer or congenital, a brave choice.
And his surgeon played his music during the operation? That's amazing.
Incredible detail. Post-surgery was tough, though. Insane pain, couldn't play guitar initially, didn't get that immediate mental health lift he'd hoped for.
But songwriting became his recovery tool, helping process the trauma.
Yes, exactly. Leading to his seventh album, he felt like a blockage was literally removed, letting words and notes flow again. Songs like World Without Empires came out.
Doctors think the effects relate to the complexities of epilepsy itself, even subtle electrical issues.
That's the suggestion. And his recovery had a community aspect too, performing for an epilepsy support group, inspiring others.
Releasing his album April Days a year later, no longer in survival mode, singing a healing sing-along with his audience.
It's just a deeply personal story, sheds light on epilepsy, challenges myths about brain surgery, and powerfully shows how creativity and community are vital for healing.
Following that, we have an interactive piece on a different health risk, plastics. Specifically, phthalates.
Right. Focusing on their potential link to pregnancy issues and infertility, this is about those pervasive, often unseen environmental health risks.
Chemicals and everyday products having long-term impacts.
Exactly. It highlights how these environmental factors, often overlooked, can profoundly affect public health, even future generations. For you, it prompts critical thinking about consumer choices, the materials in your daily life, that unseen chemical footprint.
Now, an opinion piece that might make some people uncomfortable, the uncomfortable truth about watching football.
Yeah, this one poses some tough ethical questions, especially given surveys showing NFL players suffer significant mental and physical decline from the sport.
So what does this mean for you, the casual fan?
The author frames it starkly. Would you take $5 million knowing dozens of young men would suffer later? Or just accept entertainment for their suffering? The piece argues millions press that button each week by watching.
But didn't survey find 90% of players would do it again? They love the game, they're well paid.
Yes, and the author acknowledges that player willingness. But writing as a libertarian argues ethical obligations go beyond just legal markets or consent. Fandom funds the industry, gives it status, reinforces the system attracting young men, many of whom get injured without fame or fortune.
So the author isn't saying stop watching, but
asking you to think about the crippled old men those boys will become, to question if the entertainment is really worth what you're doing to that far-off stranger.
It's a direct challenge, then. Examine the ethics of your entertainment choices, your indirect role in systems that might cause harm. Weigh enjoyment versus ethics.
It makes you pause and consider the hidden costs, definitely.
Okay, the age-old question. Is college still worth it?
Yeah.
This was debated in the letters to the editor section. What were the arguments?
A real mix of views. On the for side, some parents see it as necessary as ever. One saved since birth, frustrated by the idea college is now seen as unnecessary.
A generational view, perhaps?
Possibly. Others suggest flexibility. Thomas Fields argued, maybe don't go right away, get work experience, then get a degree makes you exceptionally valuable, maybe easier to handle debt.
And Colby Nixon argued against focusing only on money. Different colleges offer different values.
Exactly. Private colleges offer close faculty work, liberal arts broaden worldviews, public universities serve the state, community colleges give accessible skills. Nixon also stressed a key point. College teaches future leaders to rely on others, a community of peers. Critical for thoughtful decisions, avoiding bias, fosters leaders who consult experts.
What about arguments for reform or against the current system?
Harvey Graff, a professor emeritus, argued higher ed has always been about job prep, but curriculum and culture changed. He calls for reconstructing a coherent, integrated university emphasizing civic, cultural, social foundations alongside specialization.
So for you, this discussion is timely. If you're thinking about college, dealing with debt, career paths.
It provides multiple perspectives on a huge life decision and the changing role of education in society, not just about jobs, but about citizenship and leadership, too.
Now, a plea for human rights. Kathleen Parker's opinion piece urging President Trump to push for Jimmy Lai's release.
Yes, Lai, the 78-year-old Hong Kong Democratic activist and media mogul in seriously declining health, solitary confinement.
He's been in prison for nearly 5 years after a trial by China's state-selected judges.
Yes, charged under the national security law for conspiracy and sedition, basically for publishing pro-democracy views. His lawyers appealed to the UN, citing failures to provide treatment to ill prisoners. Grave concerns for him.
China's view is he lost everything for protesting their crackdown. But Parker suggests Beijing might be open to releasing him now, for health reasons. Their point is made.
That's her suggestion. And she notes Trump stated on at least three occasions he'd work for Lai's release if president. Do everything I can to save him.
The timing relates to the 40th anniversary of the Sino-British Joint Declaration, too.
Yes, and Laura Alton condemned Lai's detention as a mockery of China's promises to Hong Kong.
Parker frames it as an opportunity for quiet diplomacy, a win for Trump, a success Britain needs.
Exactly. For you, this highlights a major human rights issue, a test of diplomacy. Underscores the fragility of freedom under authoritarian regimes and the potential role of global leaders advocating for political prisoners, especially those in failing health. Makes you consider the human cost and the limits of international influence.
Okay, this next one dives into cultural differences in filmmaking. Why the world's biggest movie bombed in America? Talking about Newsaw 2.
Right, China's highest grossing film, made only $1.5 million here, despite a version with Michelle Yeoh, shows that long history of cultural misconnections for Chinese blockbusters.
Western critics found it baffling. Bizarre tone. Too many characters, complex plots, shifting allegiances.
That's what they reportedly said. It points to fundamental differences in storytelling. In China, these epic fantasies like Investiture of the Gods, which Nizai is based on, are centuries old, deeply embedded culturally, like Greek myths here. Audiences have context.
Which Western audiences lack.
Yeah.
And the structure is different, not the individual hero's journey.
More often about collectives fallen out of harmony, seeking a new balance through constant shifts. Moral ambiguity is key. Good, bad, or relative. No single hero.
And tonal whiplash. Slapstick comedy mixed with deep philosophy.
A calming feature, yes. These epics often reflect a cultural sense that everything is temporary, good and bad are relative, settling for peaceful for now. Contrasts with America's perceived narrative of continuous ascent toward greatness, clear heroes.
So for you, it's a fascinating look at cultural differences in narrative. What resonates where?
Insight into global cinema, cultural understanding, how deep values shape art, makes you consider how your own cultural lens affects what you watch and enjoy.
Okay, back to U.S. politics. Representative Ro Khanna's visit to Pennsylvania working-class voters.
Yes, he came away with a simple message he thinks Democrats need to hear. Offers a case study in bridging divides.
He spoke with Zach Richards, a union VP, who voted Obama twice, then switched to Republican in 2016.
Right. Richards cited the Democratic Party moving pretty extreme to the left on the border, trans athletes, abortion.
And Khanna engaged respectfully, probed for common ground, even on things like free college, Medicare for all, maintained a civil debate.
Yes, that's his approach. He's been doing these middle-of-somewhere visits for 9 years, consistent effort.
The electoral context is key, too. Bucks County, Erie, Luzerne, crucial bellwethers in PA.
Absolutely. Winning 3 of 5 is often key. And the Republican voter advantage in Bucks County has more than doubled since the election. Significant shift.
Khanna also talks about technology. The tension between tech firms in his district and workers worried about AI, automation replacing jobs.
Yes, he wrote a book on it. Focuses on finding ways for people to participate in the new economy without leaving their communities. And he stresses immense gratitude for those who built America, labored in mines, forged steel, believes engagement starts with respect.
For you, this gives insights into effective political engagement, the changing landscape, the importance of addressing economic anxiety with respect, not dismissal.
A lesson in trying to understand rather than just persuade.
Now for a very relatable piece for many, Theodore Johnson on turning 50 as a Gen Xer. Biting off more than I can chew.
Yeah. Grappling with midlife ambitions, the sandwich generation challenges, very relatable. He sees peers hitting 50 facing that maybe last career move decision, chase the big promotion, money dream, or downshift for work-life balance.
A generation raised to see promotions and pay as the main achievements.
Largely, yes. But now facing limited opportunities due to the market, changing workplaces, new tech.
And the sandwich generation pressure, caring for kids and aging parents simultaneously.
Creating that crisis of purpose and work and aspiration while feeling mortality more acutely.
He mentions his father's experience with the Peter Principle. Promoted beyond competence, then petering out.
But the key lesson his father shared, it doesn't mean failure, just different living to do. Redefining success.
For you, this offers a moment of reflection. Ambition, work-life balance, finding purpose beyond the traditional career ladder.
Validates those midlife struggles, encourages reevaluation, finding purpose in many forms, not just chasing external markers.
From personal purpose to public spaces. An opinion piece called Standing Room Only critiques hostile architecture.
Yes, the removal of benches, chairs, public seating, it connects this directly to the historical decision to shut down psychiatric hospitals.
Arguing that led to mentally ill people living on the streets.
That's the author's argument. Calling measures like removing seating hostile to everybody, reflecting a surrendered mindset from officials. Saying the problem addressed unhoused people is self-inflicted from deinstitutionalization without adequate support. Cites JAMA. 2/3 of unhoused people have mental health disorders.
But some communities are fighting back. Artists building benches in New Mexico. Sit-ins in Hoboken.
Yes, yeah. The benching in Silver City, the beach chair sit-in in Hoboken, grassroots resistance.
For you, this raises big social and ethical questions. Public space, treatment of vulnerable groups, community action.
It's a call to observe your own urban environment critically. Consider the social impact of design choices. Who is the city designed for? What values are embedded?
Okay, lastly in this section, a historical note. Why the Department of War became the Department of Defense.
Right. Truman renamed it in 1989. And it wasn't just PR. It was about improving efficiency and cohesion after WWII.
The War Department from 1789 oversaw the Army. Navy had its own department from 1798. WWII exposed issues with that separation.
Deeply concerned Truman. As early as 1946, he pushed for unification of all our armed services in a single department. Better coordination needed.
So he orchestrated a reorganization. National Defense Establishment in 47, then Department of Defense in 49.
Overseeing Army, Navy, and the new Air Force, all under one roof.
The goal was bureaucratic centralization. To manage power going forward, focused on defense, not war.
Exactly. Defense, not war, which after WWII was seen as an aggressive act, a deliberate shift in name and strategic intent.
For you, this explains a key piece of U.S. military history, how National Security Organization reflects changing realities and priorities, a move towards integration and a defensive posture. All right, let's dive into sports. First up, the Washington Commanders. From dumpster fire to hot destination, quite a turnaround.
It's incredible, isn't it? Feels like a complete 180. The article credits the clean slate in leadership, Josh Harris isn't Daniel Snyder. Adam Peters isn't Bruce Allen. Dan Quinn isn't Ron Rivera. Jaden Daniels isn't Sam Howell. That comprehensive change is key.
And players notice the culture shift. Defensive end Dietrich Wise Jr. highlighted the leadership change.
Yes. And owner Josh Harris emphasizes building a championship environment, attitude, people, space, showing regard for the players, a big shift.
They've invested heavily, too, $120 million in facilities.
In Loudoun County and Northwest Stadium, lockers are now plush and comfortable, chargers, big name plates, professional setup. Northwest Stadium getting 1,500 seats back in use reflects renewed optimism.
This directly addresses those terrible NFLPA grades from last year. F minuses for family treatment, locker room, training room.
Exactly. It's a direct response. And after unexpected success last season, expectations are raised this season. 5 primetime games scheduled.
Including Green Bay, Miami, and Madrid, Dallas on Christmas.
High profile.
But players like Daniels are focused on proving themselves, despite the pressure. For you, it's a compelling story of organizational change. Shows the impact of leadership, investment, culture on performance, even pro sports. A masterclass in turning things around.
Okay, NFL pickoff week. Ravens versus Bills. Dubbed the Almost Bowl. Yeah, because both teams dominate the regular season but keep running into the Chiefs in the playoffs, right? Since 2019.
So they played each other last year in the divisional round. Bills won, then lost to KC. Familiar story.
And both QBs, Jackson 28 and Allen 29, are still in their primes, offer a path to the Super Bowl. But winning the AFC is tough, usually dominated by a few elite QBs, Mahomes, Brady, Manning, Roethlisberger historically. Their existence, plus Mahomes and Burrow now, lowers individual odds.
So there's an urgent feel, even though they're young, because careers are unpredictable. Injuries happen.
Exactly. For these perennially contending teams, the window feels finite.
This week one game has less at stake than playoffs, but still significant. Final opener in Buffalo's old stadium.
And sure is a particularly frothy crowd, and the Ravens want to get that bad taste out of your mouth from last season's playoff loss.
For you, it provides context for NFL drama. Rivalries, legacies, pressure, especially at the start of the season. The struggle for glory.
Captures that blend of talent, strategy, and the constant chase for the Lombardi Trophy.
Shifting to the WNBA. Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, who drove so much attention last year, are having year two blues.
Yeah, experiencing frustration highlights the intense pressure on rising stars after a massive rookie year creates huge expectations.
Their NCAA rivalry, the championship game, made them biggest celebrities, drove record ratings for the WNBA. Huge impact.
But sophomore seasons are tough. Clark's season is over due to injury. Her coach expressed disappointment, frustration she couldn't stay healthy, but anticipates her drive to recover.
Reese's frustration played out differently. Aired issues about the team, coaching, roster publicly, hinted at leaving.
Yes, criticized the coach, the roster needs, led to a first-half suspension.
And then celebrated her video game cover on social media right after the suspension was announced. That caused a stir.
It did, raised questions about focus, timing. For you, this shows the human side of sports celebrity. The physical, mental tolls, the pressure, the evolving dynamics of team versus individual aspirations. Especially for young stars under the microscope. Shows that transition from college isn't always smooth.
Tennis now. U.S. Open final. Aryna Sabalenka repeats as champion.
Yes, world number one, 27 years old. Her second straight U.S. Open, fourth major overall. Beat Amanda Anisimova 6-3, 7-6.
Sabalenka showed control, experience, played a cleaner match.
Just 13 winners, 15 unforced errors. Very controlled. Anisimova reaching back-to-back slam finals, which is amazing, played riskier. 22 winners, 29 unforced errors.
Anisimova struggled with nerves, serve, 7 double faults. Felt frayed by the closed roof conditions.
That's what she said. The lighting change affected her.
And there was some pre-match tension from their Wimbledon semifinal. Complaints about celebrations, grunting.
Added a bit of spice to the final, yes. A simmering rivalry.
For you, it's a recap showing tactics, psychology, and elite tennis. Careers, pressures, rivalries. Mental fortitude is key.
Absolutely. It's not just physical skill at that level.
Soccer. Christian Pulisic returns to the U.S. men's national team after 5 months, but not enough to prevent a loss to South Korea.
Yeah, tough result as they look towards the 2026 World Cup on home soil. Highlights the pressure on the team and Pulisic.
He's been seen as the face of U.S. soccer for this World Cup since he was a teen, right? Nearly a decade leading the team. Star player for AC Milan.
Undisputed talent. But his decision to sit out the Gold Cup earlier drew scrutiny from the coach, fans, even ex-players like Landon Donovan.
The team struggled without him. lost friendlies as second-string team reached the Gold Cup final, creating tepid optimism.
But this 0-1 loss to South Korea, despite dominating possession and shots, was a sobering reminder. Reinforcements aren't always enough. Lack of clinical finishing hurt them.
For you, it provides context on the pressures facing the team before a home World Cup, the expectations on a star player, the challenges U.S. soccer faces globally.
Baseball quick hits, the Washington Nationals bullpen, from worst in baseball to an unthinkable run.
Dramatic turnaround. Pitching to a 2.47 ERA, best in baseball since August 16th, secured a 2-1 win versus the Cubs recently.
A month ago, a one-run lead was a nightmare. Now four relievers combined for three under scoreless innings. PJ Poulin, Clayton Beter, Jose Ferrer, Cole Henry. Credit goes to interim GM Mike DiBartolo. He made a concerted effort using the waiver wire, taking chances on pitchers with intriguing profiles, like Poulin, who never pitched in MLB before, now has a 1.56 ERA.
Beter hasn't allowed a hit in his last nine appearances. Wow.
Incredible find. Relievers credit hard work. Interim manager Cairo praises their resilience, competitiveness.
For you, it shows how strategic management, player development can turn things around. Even struggling teams can find success with the right moves and approach. A great organizational turnaround story.
Absolutely. Finding undervalued talent, giving them a chance.
College and high school football wins. Navy beat Alabama-Birmingham.
Improved to 2-0, won 38-24 despite weather delays. QB Horvath and fullback Texa led a stampeding rushing attack. Defense forced a key turnover. Overcame injuries, too. Impressive win.
And local top-ranked Damatha beat Imhotep Charter.
Also 2-M. Slow start, then a third-quarter avalanche fueled by forced turnovers. Keys had a 95-yard PD. Defense was punishing. Transfer QB Sab had three TDs total. Coach sees them on track.
For you, these recaps show the competitive spirit, strategy at different levels, local achievements, developing young talent.
Yeah, the excitement of football from college down to high school.
And finally, sadly, in memoriam, Ken Dryden and Davey Johnson passed away.
Two huge figures. Ken Dryden, Hall of Fame goalie for the Canadians, six Stanley Cups in the 70s, retired early at 31. Commissioner Bettman noted his immediate and lasting impact.
And Davey Johnson. Managed the Nats to their first playoff appearance, won the World Series with the Mets in 86, four-time All-Star player, too.
Former Nats GM Rizzo called him one of the great baseball minds. Ryan Zimmerman said he learned so much from him on and off field, known for bravado, letting personalities flourish, protecting his players.
For you, it's a moment to appreciate their careers, contributions, figures who shaped their games, inspired fans, remembering their legacies. All right, let's navigate modern life. Personal finance first. Winning the lottery, the dream, right? But it brings challenges.
Definitely. Michelle Singletary offers windfall wisdom advice for lottery winners, but useful for inheritances, settlements too.
So what's the key advice? First step.
Pause spending. Resist that impulse. Grow into the money, she says, especially if you've struggled before. Don't overdo it immediately.
Okay, pause. Then what? Where do you put it?
Safe parking. Interest-bearing, federally insured account. But not all in one place, spread it out due to protection limits. Use Bankrate.com or Investopedia to find high yield rates.
Smart. Third, get help.
Professional help. Good tax pro vital. And hire a fiduciary financial advisor. Legally required to act in your best interest, unlike advisors only needing to be suitable. Crucial difference. She even suggests counseling for prospective managing requests for help.
Ah, yes, the request. Fourth point, philanthropy. Give thoughtfully.
Yes, thoughtful philanthropy. Don't enable bad behavior. Set a specific amount you'll give, not lend. Learn to say no. Teaches responsibility. Direct people to credit counseling like NFCC.org. And be super wary of business investment requests from family unless they really know business.
Good boundaries. Finally, it's okay to celebrate a bit.
Yes. Allow celebration. Even if you're frugal, it's okay to spend within reason. It's life-changing. For you, this is a practical framework. Responsible planning, managing social dynamics, building a sustainable future, not just blowing a windfall.
Great advice. Now to the workplace. Overcoming imposter syndrome. Carla Miller's column compiled reader tips.
Such a common feeling. Many talented people feel like phonies. Society rewards definitive answers, makes ambiguity uncomfortable.
So what strategies did readers share? One named her inner demon, Kevin.
Hannah Draper did. Externalizes the self-doubt. Asks if Kevin would hesitate. If not, she gives herself permission. Disarms the inner critic.
Creative. Another found relief in authenticity. A lay pastor.
Michael Sitz. Felt like an imposter leading services. found relief embracing his authentic questioning nature, not pretending to have all answers, realized he was sharing a journey, connecting with others, seeking doubt and reconciliation.
Other tips: be a humble realist or use a mantra.
Valerie Young suggested humble realist. Jennifer Cash uses, humble enough to know I'm replaceable, cocky enough to know it's a downgrade. Captures that balance. The author suggests swaggering a bit, shutting down self-doubt with a simple, so, reclaiming authority.
For you, these tips validate the feeling, but more importantly, offer practical tools. Build self-confidence, embrace authentic leadership.
Challenge that inner Kevin. Step into your capabilities. Build resilience.
Okay, using AI effectively. Professional librarians offer tips with healthy skepticism.
Crucial guidance in this AI age. They say treat AI like a used car salesman. Trust, but most definitely verify. Instant gratification is dangerous.
Tip one, use AI for needle in a haystack searches. Broad, obscure stuff.
Where its ability to scan vast data shines, yes, that's its strength.
Tip two, the reference interview is your job. AI isn't smart enough to ask follow-ups.
You have to rephrase your question, provide more context, add examples, limit time periods, guide the AI.
Tip three, ask AI to criticize itself. Argue the opposite. Identify weaknesses. List what's missing, what biases.
Forces it to consider its own limitations. Very smart.
Tip four, maybe the most important, always verify sources.
Absolutely. Even linked sources can be wrong. Click through, verify authorship, organization, date. AI struggles with judging authority. Might surface blogs, SEO junk. Be wary if it sources Reddit or X.
Tip five, consult multiple AIs and use your own knowledge.
Ask different AIs the same question. See if they agree. And have some knowledge yourself. They're 2-book minimum to spot obvious mistakes. Also remember, AI knowledge is frozen in time, like ChatGPT-5 after SEP 30, 2024. Tell it explicitly to check up-to-date info for recent events.
For you, these are essential digital literacy skills. Critical thinking, validating info, maximizing AI tools while avoiding misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
Become a discerning digital citizen.
Absolutely vital skills now.
Okay, let's unpack this. $200 a month for 60-second dramas. Vertical streaming is a thing.
A big thing, apparently. Streaming apps winning huge audiences, charging up to 20 over a week for these mini dramas. Vertical, soap opera-like, 60-second episodes.
The example, Aline Fierope, pays over $200 a month, watching 30 series a month, one 90-minute series daily in snippets.
Compared to $17.99 a month for ad-free Netflix, it's a different model entirely. High drama, bingeable, titles like Dominated by My Dad's Boss.
They rely on shock value clips on TikTok, Facebook to lure viewers, and fans like the predictable plot lines and cliched characters.
Seems so. Comfort food entertainment, tailored for rapid mobile consumption, grew out of the attention economy, short video trends.
Quibi failed, but companies like Real Short are succeeding now, expanding genres.
Even dating shows, documentaries, and independent creators are thriving too. Scott Brown's The Diamond Rose got 20 million views in 24 hours. Viral power.
And it's impacting Hollywood. Roles for vertical dramas make up half of casting listings now. Actors becoming stars from these.
Casey Esser mentioned as an example, a new path to fame. For you, this highlights changing media landscapes, digital content economics, the psychological hooks, how new tech and habits are reshaping entertainment, the future of storytelling.
Wow. Okay. From digital drama to yarn, American knitters tangled up in tariffs.
An unexpected consequence of trade policy. Ending the de minimis exemption for imports means Euro yarn brands are suspending direct U.S. shipments.
Causing higher prices, supply issues for knitters.
Exactly. Brooklyn store owner Catherine Clark fears it could put her out of business. Not enough U.S. yarn to meet demand. Danish brand Knitting for Olive expects to double shipping fees to $20, plus a new 15% tariff hits their biggest market.
And knitting had a resurgence during the pandemic. Crafters buy direct or from indie stores mostly.
Right. Adds to the challenge. The ambiguity of the duty collection process. Tariff invoices arrive after delivery. Hard for small stores. Companies worry delays and costs will impact choosy consumers. While some try to buy American, many knitters prioritize quality, color, feel, regardless of origin.
Experts are skeptical restrictions will actually boost U.S. producers.
Seems so. For you, it shows how broad economic decisions affect niche markets, passionate consumers, personal hobbies, small businesses, availability of goods, the ripple effects of policy, far beyond headlines, how DC decisions impact a skein of yarn.
Now a book review. Fumio Yamamoto's The Dilemmas of Working Women, first English translation of a Japanese bestseller.
explores how work, or its absence, shapes identity and relationships in capitalism. Resonates now with economic anxiety millions unemployed or functionally unemployed.
The review mentions five stories, each showing a different relationship to work. Like Naked, follows Izumi, unemployed after her husband fired her during divorce.
She explores the true meaning of having free time, questions living without working when society equates identity with work.
And Planarian, Haruka, recovering from stage 4 cancer, struggles with pressure to get over it, get a job, while still distressed.
Yearns to be a planarian, the flatworm with regeneration abilities, to easily heal. Poignant.
For you, this offers a profound look at identity, purpose, social expectations around work, especially for women.
A lens for self-reflection on your own relationship with work, finding acceptance outside traditional careers, challenges of finding worth in a work-centric world.
Finally, the advice columns. Always interesting dilemmas. Asking Eric. Single mom wants to date her handyman, but her cousin dated him previously.
Eric advises, life is not a Hallmark movie. Encourages open communication, grounded advice.
Asks Sahaj, oldest daughter in an immigrant family feels guilty setting boundaries with needy critical parents, especially over her interracial relationship.
Sahaj is direct. You will feel selfish, but you will have to set these boundaries anyway. Start small, protect your nervous system, distinguish love wanting from fear duty. Powerful.
Carolyn asks, do I tell? Reader wonders if they should tell a friend her husband hit on them, weighing friendship versus certainty.
Hack says no single answer. Depends on the connection quality, confidence, the info is good, that the husband is bad. If so, the friend is party to a lie. But the messenger risks butting out. Tough call.
For you, these columns offer practical, empathetic guidance. Navigating relationships, family, self-care. Relatable scenarios, thoughtful approaches. Reminds you struggles are shared. Hashtag tag 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 outro. Wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground today, really explored the breadth of the Washington Post for Sunday, September 7th, 2025. From DC politics to global hotspots, personal health journeys, the ethics of football, it really shows how interconnected everything is. Every decision has ripples.
It really does. And consistent themes emerge, don't they? That tension between personal autonomy and external pressures. Yeah. We saw it with the mayor, the musician Mike Frazier, the daughter setting boundaries, even the athletes facing fame's demands. That struggle for self-determination.
And how policy tariffs, vaccine mandates isn't abstract. It reaches right into your wallet, your health, your job prospects, even your knitting. Governance touches every corner.
Which brings up a key question for you, the listener. In this age of just overwhelming information, constant connection, how do you stay informed without feeling completely swamped? How do you weave these diverse stories together into a coherent understanding of the world without just getting lost in the noise?
It's a real challenge. But one we hope these deep dives help you navigate a bit more easily. We encourage you to reflect, connect these stories to your own life. Keep asking those important questions.
And remember, critical thinking isn't just about questioning what you read or hear. It's fundamentally about understanding the why, the context, the broader implications for you and the world.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the Washington Post for Sunday, September 7th, 2025. We hope you feel a little more well-informed and maybe, just maybe, a little more curious about this complex, fascinating world around you.